All right, if there's no further discussion, the motion before the board is to instruct the staff to release the proposed temporary inspection rule for broker-dealer audits for public comment for 60 days. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. The second item on the agenda is a recommendation that the board propose amendments to its funding rules. And for that recommendation, I'll turn again to our general counsel's office, to Gordon Seymour.
Thank you, Chairman Gelzer. on behalf of the Office of General Counsel, I'm pleased to recommend that the board propose amendments to its funding rules. Since the board's inception, the primary source of the board's funds has been what the Sarbanes-Oxley Act calls the board's accounting support fee. As required by the Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among public companies and investment companies based on their relative equity market capitalizations. As we've been discussing today, the Dodd-Frank Act assigned the board the additional responsibility to oversee the audit of broker-dealers. To pay for that oversight, Dodd-Frank directs the board to allocate the accounting support fee among not only public companies and investment companies, but also among brokers and dealers. The proposals we're presenting today would implement those provisions of Dodd-Frank and provide for a portion of the board's accounting support fee to be allocated among securities brokers and dealers. We're also recommending today certain changes to the existing rules applicable to the portion of the accounting support fee that would continue to be allocated among public companies and investment companies. These changes are based on 8 years of experience administering the funding rules and are designed to make the funding process both more efficient and more cost-effective for all concerned. Nina Majeri-Azad, Assistant General Counsel, and Annie Braswell, Accounting Supervisor in the Office of Finance, will present the staff's recommendation. Before I turn the floor over to Nina and Annie, though, I would like to acknowledge the work of both Nina and Annie, as well as, again, Bob Burns from the Office of General Counsel. Bob, Annie, and Nina have spent countless hours analyzing the Dodd-Frank Act, crunching the numbers, and doing everything else that went into putting this proposal together. I also want to acknowledge the substantial assistance we received from other offices on this proposal. In particular, I want to thank Tim Gustafson, Elena Bajkova, and Kevin Murphy of our Office of Research and Analysis for their work obtaining and analyzing significant amounts of data related to broker-dealers. Also, Naveen Hanumansetti of our IT department has assisted us in gathering, compiling, and doing quality checks on the data that we used. And with that, let me turn things over to Nina to present the proposal.
Thank you, Gordon. Chairman Gelzer and members of the board, as Gordon stated, the Dodd-Frank Act amended Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to require for the equitable allocation, assessment, and collection by the board of its accounting support fee among issuers and brokers and dealers. As reflected in the 2011 budget recently approved by the board, which is subject to commission approval, the board's total accounting support fee for 2011 is allocated between issuers and brokers and dealers. The Dodd-Frank amendments require that the basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee among brokers and dealers or classes of brokers and dealers be based on their relative net capital before or after any adjustments compared to the total net capital of all brokers and dealers before or after any adjustments. The reference to adjustments permits the board to allocate the fee based on tentative net capital, which is net capital before deducting certain securities haircuts and changes in inventory used in calculating the broker or dealer's net capital. Because the investment decisions made by a broker or dealer can influence the amount of these deductions and thus influence the net capital calculation, we believe that tentative net capital may be a more consistent basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee than net capital. Accordingly, we are recommending that the board base the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee among brokers and dealers based on tentative net capital. Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, as amended by the Dodd-Frank Act, also allows the board to differentiate among classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes, just as the board has been permitted to do for issuers. Differentiating brokers and dealers by classes allows the board to allocate the broker-dealer accounting support fee to those brokers and dealers whose audits, due to their relative size and complexity, may require more board time and resources during an inspection than other audits of brokers and dealers with relatively small and less complex operations. To allow for the equitable distribution of the broker-dealer accounting support fee, we recommend that the board propose to create two classes of brokers and dealers. Class 1 would include brokers or dealers with average quarterly tentative net capital greater than $5 million. Class 2 would include brokers or dealers with average quarterly tentative net capital less than or equal to $5 million, or those that do not file audited financial statements pursuant to a commission rule or other action of the commission or its staff. Brokers and dealers falling under Class 2 would be allocated a share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee equal to zero. Brokers and dealers in Class 1 would be allocated a share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee based on a ratio where the numerator is the average quarterly tentative net capital of the broker-dealer for the calendar quarter of the immediately prior calendar year, and the denominator is the sum of the average quarterly tentative net capital of all brokers and dealers in the class. Based on data received from FINRA, the staff anticipate that under this proposed $5 million threshold, approximately 15% of the broker-dealer population would be in Class 1 and assess the fee. We are also recommending that the board propose amendments to the board's current rules regarding the assessment and collection of the accounting support fee to include appropriate references to brokers and dealers. For example, currently, if a share of the accounting support fee allocated to an issuer is past due and the issuer has not filed a petition with the board seeking correction of its assigned share, then, with certain exceptions, no registered public accounting firm is permitted to sign an unqualified audit opinion with respect to that issuer's financial statements or to sign a consent to the use of prior audit opinion for that issuer. Under the proposal before you today, the same concept would be extended to brokers and dealers in that no registered public accounting firm would be permitted to sign an unqualified audit opinion with respect to that broker or dealer's financial statements, sign a consent to the use of a prior audit opinion, or sign an audit report or a document, report, notice, or other record concerning procedures or controls for that broker-dealer if its share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee is past due and no petition for correction has been filed. In addition, similar to issuers, brokers and dealers would be assessed monthly finance charges at a rate of 6% per year if they have an outstanding balance after 60 days of the date of their invoice. If a broker-dealer has an outstanding balance after the 90th day of the original invoice date, then the board may report nonpayment through the commission or the issuer's or broker's designated examining authority. In addition to the above recommendations related to the broker-dealer accounting support fee, we are also recommending certain amendments to the board's existing rules for the allocation, assessment, and collection of the issuer accounting support fee. As you know, the board has conducted its funding under these rules since 2003. While the rules generally have functioned as intended, we believe that the allocation and assessment process could be more efficient in some respects. Annie will discuss most of the proposed amendments to the board's funding rules with respect to issuers. However, I would like to highlight one proposed change for your attention. As required under Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among issuers based on their relative average monthly equity market capitalizations. Under the board's current rules, an issuer's market capitalization is based on the aggregate market value of all classes of the issuer's common stock that trade in the United States. Determining whether certain types of securities not identified as common stock, such as limited partnership interests, should be included in an issuer's market capitalization, however, has led to interpretive issues. To reduce such issues, we are recommending that the board propose amending the definition of issuer market capitalization and market capitalization of an issuer by replacing the reference to common stock with a reference to voting and non-voting common equity. Thus, an issuer's market cap would be based on the issuer's aggregate market value of all classes of voting and non-voting common equity traded in the United States. The term common equity would track the definition of Rule 12b-2 under the Exchange Act, which includes any class of common stock or an equivalent interest, including but not limited to a unit of beneficial interest in a trust or a limited partnership interest. Therefore, under this proposal, an issuer's market capitalization will be slightly expanded to include not only any class of common stock or equivalent interest, but also any beneficial interest in a trust or limited partnership interest, and any other security that the Commission, by rule, deems to treat as common equity. Preferred stock, warrants, and options would continue to be excluded when calculating an issuer's market capitalization. I would now like to turn it over to Annie, who will describe other proposed amendments to the Board's funding rules concerning issuers.
Thank you, Nina. In addition to the modification of the definition of issuer market capitalization, the amendments before the Board propose an increase in the market cap thresholds for issuer classes 1 and 2. Issuers in these classes are allocated portions of the issuer accounting support fee based on their relative average monthly market capitalizations. Currently, Class 1 issuers include public companies with average monthly U.S. market cap more than $25 million each, and Class 2 includes investment companies with average monthly net asset value or U.S. market cap greater than $250 million each. The proposal would increase the market cap thresholds from $25 million to $75 million for Class 1 issuers, which includes public companies, and from $250 million to $500 million for Class 2 issuers, which includes investment companies. We believe the increase in these thresholds allows for a more efficient funding process and reduces administrative burdens on the smaller issuers, with minimal effect on the assessments to other issuers. Additionally, we are proposing modifications to the consideration of issuers that are in bankruptcy and meet the modified reporting requirements of SEC Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2, whereby they are not required to file audited financial statements with the Commission. These issuers fall under the third class of issuers and are allocated a share of the accounting support fee equal to zero. In a number of instances, companies in bankruptcy who file modified reports will notify the PCAOB that they meet the conditions for modified reporting under Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 and should be allocated a share of the accounting support fee equal to zero. It is difficult, however, for PCAOB staff to verify such assertions since there is no requirement in Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 or elsewhere that an issuer ask for no action relief or otherwise receive acknowledgement from the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance prior to filing modified reports. Rather, we understand that such issuers that believe that they meet the conditions in Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 may choose to file modified reports with the Commission. To avoid PCAOB staff having to determine whether or not a bankrupt issuer meets the conditions set forth in that legal bulletin, the proposed amendments would clarify that in order to be placed in Class 3, an issuer in bankruptcy that asserts to the PCAOB that it meets modified reporting requirements of Staff Legal Bulletin Number 2 must provide an opinion of counsel that the issuer met those requirements on the date that the accounting support fee was calculated. Further, the proposed amendments would extend the time frame within which an issuer, broker, or dealer may petition the board for correction of the class in which it's been placed or its allocated share of the accounting support fee. The current funding rules permit petitions for correction to be received within 30 days of the invoice date. However, staff has found over the past funding cycles that issuers rarely deliver petitions to the board within those 30 days, and staff typically has accepted and considered petitions received after that point. The proposed amendments extend that time frame in which issuers, brokers, and dealers may file a petition with the board from 30 days to 60 days. In addition, the proposal would allow acceptance of petitions for correction past the 60 days when due cause is shown. Finally, with regard to a registered accounting firm ascertaining that its issuer, broker, or dealer client has paid its share of the accounting support fee, the proposed amendments would clarify that it is not mandatory that a registered accounting firm obtain confirmation from the board prior to signing an unqualified audit opinion, consenting to include an audit report issued previously, or signing a document, report, notice, or other record concerning procedures or controls of its issuer, broker, or dealer client. Rather, the firm may ascertain that its client has paid through various other means. As such, the proposed amendments replace the word confirmation with the word determination in the caption for Rule 7104B and remove specific reference to obtaining confirmation from the board. This proposed modification is in recognition that confirmation is only one of a number of procedures available to a registered public accounting firm when determining whether its client has any outstanding past due share of the accounting support fee. Under the Dodd-Frank amendments to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the PCAOB is required to begin allocation, assessment, and collection of the accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund its first fiscal year after the date the Dodd-Frank Act enactment, which is the 2011 calendar year. As such, we expect that subject to approval of the funding rules by the SEC, the funding rules would be effective for the 2011 funding cycle for brokers and dealers and for the 2012 funding cycle for issuers. We are recommending that the board publish for public comment these proposed amendments for a 60-day period. Accordingly, all comments must be received no later than February 15, 2011. We will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Majuri-Assad and Ms. Braswell. Let me turn to the other members of the board then and ask if there are any motions concerning this matter.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Harris.
I move that the board instruct the staff to release the proposed amendments to the board's funding rules as recommended for public comment for a period of 60 days.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Gradison. Let me make some comments about this proposal. The primary purpose of the proposed amendments to the funding rules that are before the board for consideration today is to create a framework for obtaining the resources necessary to support the cost of the board's oversight of auditors of securities brokers and dealers. When Congress created the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board in 2002, it gave the board responsibility to oversee the auditors of U.S. public companies and provided that the board's work would be funded by those public companies in proportion to each issuer's market capitalization. This summer, in the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress expanded the board's responsibilities to include the auditors of all SEC-registered securities brokers and dealers. Building on the 2002 approach to board self-funding, Dodd-Frank provides that the board is to equitably allocate its resources between public companies and broker-dealers. Broker-dealers are required to contribute to their industry's share of board funding in proportion to net capital. Broker-dealer net capital is highly concentrated. As I noted in my statement this morning regarding the interim inspection program, only 33 firms have net capital in excess of $1 billion, and those firms hold about 80% of the net capital of the entire broker-dealer industry. The great majority of brokerage firms, however, are very small. Under any allocation methodology that's based on a firm's share of total industry net capital, several thousand broker-dealers would pay nothing simply because of the board's practice of rounding fee allocations to the nearest $100. Under the proposed funding rules, only broker-dealers that have tentative net capital in excess of $5 million would be allocated a share of the board's accounting support fee. Of the 5,000 or so SEC-registered broker-dealers, about 640 firms currently exceed the $5 million threshold. The board has estimated that in 2011, about 7.1% of its budget, or roughly $15 million, will be devoted to the oversight of broker-dealer auditors. As a result, under the proposed rule, in 2011, brokerage firm support fees would range from a low of $400 to a high of about $1.2 million. Roughly 100 of the 640 firms would pay $500 or less. Three firms would pay over $1 million. As we've heard, a secondary purpose of the proposed funding rule amendments is to revise the rules related to public company support fees. While the proposals include several technical changes, the aspect of those revisions that will have the greatest practical effect is the proposed increase in the market capitalization threshold. Under the current rules, all public companies that have market capitalizations of at least $25 million must contribute to the funding of the board's issuer-auditor oversight work. The proposal before the board today would increase that threshold to $75 million, the same as the SEC threshold for accelerated filer status. As a result, about 1,100 issuers with market capitalizations between $25 million and $75 million will no longer be subject to the support fee allocation. Granting relief to these small public companies will have only a negligible impact on the support fee payments of larger issuers, since public companies with market capitalizations below $75 million currently pay, as a group, only about 0.4% of the board's total accounting support fee. The proposed revisions would also increase the market capitalization, or actually net asset value, threshold from $250 million to $500 million for investment companies. That change would have the effect of reducing to zero the fee allocation of about 1,480 investment companies. I believe that the proposed broker-dealer funding rules and the changes to the public company funding rules are fully consistent with Congress's objective of requiring that public companies and broker-dealers provide the resources for board oversight of their auditors. The proposals would accomplish that goal without burdening smaller public companies, smaller broker-dealers, and smaller investment companies. I support the proposed funding rule changes. These amendments were a joint effort of the Office of the General Counsel and the Office of Finance. I want to also join in thanking Bob Burns, Associate General Counsel, Nina Mojari-Assad, Assistant General Counsel, and Annie Braswell, Accounting Supervisor in the Office of Finance, for their work on this project. Let me ask the other board members if they have comments or questions. And Mr. Harris, I'll begin with you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me emphasize what you've already so clearly explained, and that is, as with the proposed temporary rule for an interim program of inspections, the proposed fee structure we are considering today is highly considerate of the financial burden on smaller broker-dealers. As Nina, Allison, and you have said, to date, the primary source of board funds has been the accounting support fee paid by public companies and investment companies. The Dodd-Frank Act specifies that the cost of the board's expanded responsibility should be allocated among brokers and dealers. And the Act allows the board to differentiate among classes of broker-dealers. It requires that the amount be calculated based on relative net capital before or after certain adjustments, in other words, tentative net capital. The board's proposing release contains information obtained from the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, which shows that the majority of tentative net capital in the industry is highly concentrated in relatively few companies. Indeed, approximately 86% of broker-dealers have about 1% of the industry's capital, and conversely, 99% of the industry's tentative net capital is held by just 14% of the industry. The board is proposing, as you've mentioned, to exclude brokers and dealers with tentative net capital of less than $5 million, 86% of the industry, from the accounting support fee. Therefore, under today's proposal, those smaller broker-dealers would not receive an invoice from the PCOB. The board is making similar proposals in the funding rules regarding the fees paid by public companies and investment companies. Currently, companies under a certain market capitalization are not allocated a portion of the accounting support fee. As explained in the release and as discussed earlier under the proposal, these market capitalization thresholds would be raised, and as a result, the number of companies that do not receive an invoice from the PCOB would increase. As a group, it is expected that this proposed reallocation would have a negligible effect on the fees allocated to other companies. In summary, the board's proposals today The inspection program and funding rules reflect the board's sensitivity to the costs that may be imposed on smaller entities while maintaining our primary focus on investor protection. I look forward to receiving the comments on both proposals and to moving forward with the development of our broker-dealer audit oversight programs. And before I close, I would like to join you, Mr. Chairman, in thanking the staff for their efforts and thorough analysis in developing these proposed rules before us today. In particular, I would like to thank our general counsel, Gordon Seymour, Michael Stevenson, Bob Burns, and Nina Majuri-Azad from the general counsel's office, and Annie Braswell from the finance office, and on the prior recommendations, George Giacant and Bob Modet, and the research and analysis division, and others who have been referenced to my who I don't recall the exact names of, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris. Mr. Grattison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand, the statute commands us to come up with an equitable allocation of these costs between issuers and the broker-dealers, which on its surface suggests that they're two different classes of organizations, but they're really not. It isn't that clear, as near as I can think this through, that they're either fish or they're fowl. And that is because in a typical situation today involving most, if not all, of the large broker-dealers, they're already subject to inspections. There's a publicly held holding company, and then beneath that there is a broker-dealer. And I've been trying to figure out, we'll get comments on this if there are any concerns on the outside. I'm just trying to think whether I should have any concerns about this, because the funding scheme relies upon the funds from the big ones, many of whom, I'm not saying all, but many of whom are parts of public companies to pay the costs of the inspections for this large universe, many of whom, quite properly, are being exempted from paying anything at all. So I guess my key question is, because the statute refers to an equitable allocation, will there be significantly more costs incurred by our inspection division in taking a look at public broker-dealers as a result of this new legislation than there have been in the past when they were being inspected because of their being, in many cases, the whole operating part of an issuer?
Yeah, let me talk about that for a minute. It's an interesting question, and it's one, as you know, in the budget process, I think the board has been thinking about quite thoroughly. I think so far as when PCOB inspectors go out to look at an entity, an issuer that has a broker-dealer subsidiary, and they're going to actually include some of those audits in their program to go out and do it. And hopefully they will do this all at one time. In other words, as I understand it, although Bob Madej and others can explain this better than I can, it will probably be part of one trip, so to speak, out to the issuer and to the subsidiary, and they hope to do it all at one time and kind of wrap it up in one inspection. So we hope to keep costs reduced to that extent. It really depends on how the inspection program for broker-dealers is developed and what they decide should be looked at and how it goes into. A lot of that we really won't know until we get through the interim inspection program to decide where the real risks are and what needs to be examined and what types of operations within these broker-dealers pose the real risk, what types of broker-dealers warrant more time than other broker-dealers. So, unfortunately, the answer to your question right now is one that I can't really give you a definitive answer to. I think that we're going to be studying those questions. I think over the next year or so, hopefully, we'll come up with a lot better answers. We'll come up with a program that we think will do the job at the same time, not impose any unreasonable burden or cost on the people involved. But it's going to be an evolving process, and it's one that's going to actually feed into the standards that we write, to the inspection program, to all, the whole setup as we go forward. So, if your question is how we're going to manage the cost involved and how we're going to, the inspection program is going to work and how they're going to actually do it, we will be looking at that.
Just if I could to add to what Bob said, the premise for the proposal today is as you reflected, Board Member Grandison, in your question, that there would be a separate bill in the situation you're describing of a issuer holding company and a broker-dealer subsidiary. Those two, and those would be two separate legal entities, each with their own treated separately, each with their own obligations under the securities laws, each with their own audit requirement, they would, under this proposal, receive two separate bills. You're correct, there could be some overlap in the audit work we might look at as part of the issuer audit and at least our inspection work on the broker-dealer's financial statement audit. At the same time, there might not be overlap. There might be some work for the broker-dealer's financial statement audit that wouldn't be looked at as part of our looking at the issuer's audit engagement. Probably more significantly, there are additional engagements the auditor has to perform under the securities laws for the broker-dealer, as you well know, the compliance-type work that has to be done that would be part of our inspection program and our general oversight of the broker-dealer's audit that would not be captured today in our issuer audit program. So that's the premise for the approach before you, but again, we're certainly open to receiving comments on this point.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Grandison. Mr. Niemeyer.
Sure. Well, to start, Annie, Nina, Bob, you've done a great job on this, working up this proposal. I'd also like to thank, though, the many other staff in the Office of Finance, the General Counsel's Office, and IT, who operate our funding process every year. There's no doubt our funding process is critical to our ability to maintain effective programs. And yet the process runs so smoothly that from the outside it might appear to be effortless to us. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Act requires us to allocate our accounting support fee across public companies according to the relative market cap. Obtaining and managing the data necessary to calculate each company's assessment is an enormous job in and of itself. But then there's collection. On average each year, more than 90% of our fee is collected within 60 days of billing. But under the Act and related rules, our staff still has to track down and work through the reasons for non-payment by a few hundred issuers, with, for the most part, relatively small amounts to collect right off. That in itself is another enormous task. Our funding process does take considerable time every year, including the time of key employees. This process will now have to occur twice a year because of the addition of broker-dealer assessments, which, as described in the proposal, requires completely different information and analysis to calculate. The proposed rules benefit from your experience operating the issuer funding process over the years, and I support it. Your proposed appropriate classes and thresholds consistent with the Dodd-Frank Act, which to the extent possible would result in accessing an optimal number of broker-dealers to keep fees low relative to tentative net capital while avoiding the administrative cost of a high level of very small bills. I also support the amendments you propose to improve the issuer funding rules based on the 8 cycles of experience and to conserve valuable staff and other resources for tasks more directly related to our programs. I look forward to public comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Let me ask a couple questions about the proposal. First, at least if the numbers in my statement were correct and if the rule is ultimately adopted, about 640 brokerage firms can expect to receive a notice from the PCAOB. When would you anticipate that those would go out in 2011?
Section 109D of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, as amended, states that the board is to begin allocation assessment and collection of the accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund the first full fiscal year after the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act, which would be the 2011 funding cycle. So we are hoping that the board would approve or adopt, and the SEC will approve the funding rules as amended in the first half of 2011, and then we would have the opportunity to assess and collect the accounting support fee within the second half of 2011.
So sometime in, I would guess the fall.
Yes, we're expecting the fall time frame.
We send the issuer accounting support fee notices, well, I guess usually in late March, early April, somewhere in that time frame. After 2011, would you envision that the broker-dealer support fee notices would go on the same schedule, or will they continue to be at a different time of year?
After 2011, we're not certain that they would go out at the same time. We do, as you mentioned, conduct that in the issuer accounting support fee assessment in the first half of the year. And for brokers and dealers, we would need to look at the availability of data from external data providers as well as some other factors that would go into that to determine if that is feasible to assess them around the same time. Regardless, the staff always strives to conduct the assessment process in the most cost-efficient manner.
Okay, well, since you mentioned the data, and as I understand it, we're able to get the market capitalization data that we use for the issuer accounting support fee from, I guess, basically commercial sources. How are we going to get tentative net capital information? Are there commercial sources for that, too?
Well, tentative capital is reported on focus reports, and those reports essentially go to FINRA and other designated examining authorities for broker-dealers. So we've been getting data from FINRA, and we're working out agreements to get it from the other examining authorities as well. So we will hopefully get it directly from them.
Do those FINRA and the other examining authorities get that information electronically, or will it have to be?
It comes in electronic.
It does come
we
in
get
electronic.
There
was some discussion on the previous item about our ability ultimately to exempt some categories of broker-dealer auditors from PCAOB oversight. What effect would that have on the brokerage firms that those auditors audit from a support fee perspective? In other words, if you're in a category where your auditor is exempted, are you still, at least in theory, subject to receiving a support fee assessment?
No. The reason is that in Section 109, it uses the term broker and it uses the term dealer, but when you look at the definition of those terms, it was added to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act by the Dodd-Frank Act. It essentially means brokers and dealers who are required to have a registered public accounting firm do their audit. So if you're not required to have a registered public accounting firm do your audit, you're not within the definition of broker within Section 109, which means you're not subject to the fee. So they're out.
Okay. Mr. Gradison brought out one point that I wanted to ask you about, and that is the potential for one holding company, one corporate family to receive more than one assessment, one as a public company and one because of having a broker-dealer affiliate. Do you know if there are any financial conglomerates that have more than one broker-dealer affiliate? There's certainly nothing impossible about that. So there could be entities that would receive more than two assessments, multiple assessments.
Yeah, I honestly don't know whether they have more than one broker-dealer. I think it would be the billing would probably depend on how they're regulated and how they file focus reports and how they're overseen by FINRA and the SEC, because to be perfectly honest, that's what we're using as part of the funding process.
Maybe some mutual funds could be in that situation too, if they have a sub that's handling the trades for just that fund.
Right, right. And yeah. So we do, you know, expect, obviously the first time around, we may hear from some and have to consider some of those issues once it comes up.
I suppose there's nothing really very novel. But I mean, the large fund complexes must receive numerous assessments from us because each fund is separately.
Right, we invoice at the series level, so a trust may receive several invoices.
And I wanted to ask about the consequences of non-payment. And Nina, I think you covered that in your comments in terms of the inability to sign an audit report. If I recall correctly, there's a direct obligation in Section 13, I think, of the Exchange Act to pay. In other words, the SEC can bring an enforcement action against an entity that doesn't pay. That's sort of the ultimate sanction. Is there something comparable with respect to the broker-dealer assessments, or is the reliance going to be solely on this inability to get audits signed?
Yeah. Well, Section 109H1 of Sarbanes-Oxley provides that each broker and dealer shall pay to the board the annual accounting support fee. As I mentioned in my statement, we will report non-payments to the SEC or the broker-dealer's designated examining agency. And at that point, they would be able to take any action that they see reasonable.
Okay. So I guess ultimately SEC enforcement action is the shotgun behind the door here, I guess. I'm not sure they've ever brought any on the issue fees. I know they've or I believe they've threatened them sometimes, which has had the effect of bringing the money in from non-payers. Let me switch for a minute to the issuer funding rule changes. I think you described the difference between common stock and common equities. I won't cover that again. But you also commented that other classes of equity, like preferred stock and stock warrants, aren't included in our definition, I guess because of the use of the word common. Why is that? Why not include preferred stock, for example, in determining assessments?
Sure. Certain types of securities, such as preferred stock, warrants, and options, may represent an obligation on the part of the issuer rather than be a component of the issuer's equity, and therefore it's not clear whether that would fall under the Section 109 requirement that an issuer's equity market capitalization be considered when allocating the issuer accounting support fee.
There's two other things. First, we're the collection agent for the FASB, whose budget is funded essentially in the same way from issuers. How will the FASB be affected by these rule changes? I guess they won't be affected by the broker-dealer rule change at all, but will the base for their support fee change with respect to common stock versus common equity in the same way that ours will?
Sure. As you noted, the issuers would be required to pay the FASB accounting support fee. However, brokers and dealers would not, and it would continue going forward that way. The FASB did designate us as their collection agent, and in doing so, designated that the allocation formula set forth in our funding rules would be used for their allocation of the accounting support fee. So any changes to the issuer funding rules that we've referenced today that are in the amendment would be effectively the same for the FASB accounting support fee assessment as well.
Do they have to agree to that?
Discussed the proposed amendments with FASB, and they're aware of these changes.
Sargent's actually provides for them to be funded in the same manner as the PCAOB. They've voluntarily agreed to designate us as their collection agent. Theoretically, they could choose someone else, but given that it's the same methodology, we need to, at a general level, the level of the Act, that we need to use for our issuer funding, it does make a lot of sense for, as a matter of efficiency, for them to use us for this purpose, and I think we'd expect that to continue.
Well, that was my question. Do they have to agree to these changes?
No, I think at the FAF, the Financial Accounting Foundation level, I think they've pretty much indicated that they look to the PCOB's rules so far as determination of the fee and calculation, that kind of thing. So I think they've essentially already bought in, so to speak, to the PCOB's methodologies and so on. And we did, as Nina indicated, or it's been indicated before, we did share this with them. We've talked with the General Counsel's office. They have indicated to us, at least at this point in time, again, this is a proposal, but they've indicated to us that they have no issues, that they've satisfied with it. So,
do you have any sense of how this will affect individual issuers, individual public companies? I mean, are there companies out there that are likely to see their assessment go significantly up or significantly down because of this common stock versus common equity change?
Well, as you mentioned in your statement, only about 1,100 public companies on average over the past six funding cycles fall within that $25 million to $75 million market cap range. And that's about 23% of the equity issuers out there that were assessed a portion of the fee. However, they only paid about 0.4% of the total accounting support fee on average over those six cycles. Similarly, for investment companies, there are about 33% that fall in the $250 to $500 million market cap range. And they only ended up paying about 0.3% on average of the total accounting support fee. So essentially, they're paying less than 1% of the total accounting support fee. And allocating that over 2,500 issuers is not efficient for us, and also inflicts a burden on the smaller companies that when you reallocate that to the other issuers, It's not a big burden that they take on. And I would note that in looking at the numbers, companies with typically $600 million or more would see an increase in their fee range, in their fee. Companies with $600 million market cap and above. So those below that typically do not see, in general, an increase in their fee.
Well, I'm with you on that, and I'm glad you make those points, because I like those 1,100 public companies and 1,460 mm-hmm. or whatever it is investment companies to know that they're going out of the system. But I guess my question is slightly different, and that is the change from common stock to common equity likely to have a significant effect on anybody remaining in the system? And perhaps we don't know the answer to that.
Right, yeah. Right now, we don't necessarily have the answer to that. As we mentioned, there's a lot of interpretive questions that have just been posed when we're operating under the common stock market cap definition, and we'll be looking at that during the 2011 funding cycle.
Just offhand, I suppose maybe I'm the least informed person in the room to answer the question, but I would think that when you put the change together with the way the staff has been interpreting the rule, it isn't likely to have a significant effect on that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to add. I think the way that we've been interpreting it, I don't think this will result in much of a change. I think what we're trying to do is make the rule clearer as to what we really intend, because there were a lot of questions as to what does common stock, that phrase, actually mean in the funding rules. And I think in answering all those questions that come up, I think we've gotten closer on certain occasions to where the SEC has been on determining what common equity might be. So.
Just one last thing. I mean, Mr. Neumeyer made the point about all the work that has to go on behind the scenes here in order to get the accounting support fee notices out and how well that's operated over the last cycles. A lot of that, a significant part of that, occurs in the IT part of our operation. What are going to be the internal ramifications, particularly the IT ramifications, of creating the broker-dealer funding system? Does that mean a new system has to be built, and how well prepared are we to do that by the second half of the year?
Well, we've initiated discussions with the Office of Information Technology to determine how best to implement the assessment of the broker-dealer accounting support fee. It's not clear at this point whether or not we'd be able to use the current funding system and expand that to allow for broker-dealer assessment. But we, again, have begun talks and do not foresee that that would, you know, either if it's creating a new system or implementing changes to the current funding system, that it would delay us or keep us from assessing the accounting support fee for brokers and dealers in the second half of 2011.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion or comments?
I was wondering, how did you come up with just the two classes of broker-dealers? What were some of the factors that you considered in creating just those two?
Sure. As we mentioned, we obtained data from FINRA for about 4,600 broker-dealers, and we looked at the tentative net capital, the dispersion of broker-dealers for tentative net capital. And as has been mentioned, a significant number, roughly about 4,000, have less than $5 million tentative net capital, while only a small percentage, only 33, hold 80% of the tentative net capital in the broker-dealer population. We had looked at the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee using no threshold, and under that scenario, assuming a $15 million broker-dealer accounting support fee, we noted that approximately 3,000 of the broker-dealers would not be assessed the fee, sometime due to the rounding of our rules. When we increased the threshold to $5 million, 919 additional broker-dealers would not be assessed a fee. However, the total fee that those 919 broker-dealers that would have been paying under the no threshold would have been only roughly about $140,000, which is less than 1%. And we felt that distributing that less than 1% fee to the 640 broker-dealers that are above the $5 million net capital, tentative net capital, is very negligible impact on their bills.
Steve, can I interject something about that just before you go? I think we see in another part of the comments today that about 500 firms either clear or have custody of client assets, which is actually a higher number than I would have thought, but I think we have that at least roughly from somewhere, and that 460 firms are going to be paying the support fee. Do we know if those two pretty much overlap? In other words, that we won't be assessing introducing firms that don't have custody of client assets?
I don't think that we can tell you with any degree of certainty that that's the case. I think we assume that there's some relationship there, but I couldn't tell you for certain.
I would think that there would, well, there may be some exceptions, that there would be pretty close overlap between those.
I would guess so, but I don't know.
And Annie, I think I missed your explanation here. In terms of when you raised a threshold from $75 million and $500 million, it will not have a significant impact on the remaining companies that have to pay a fee. But could you explain again why that's the case?
Well, the companies, for public companies, that fall between the range, based on the last six funding cycles, between the range of $25 million and $75 million in market cap, they only pay about 0.4% of the total accounting support fee. Additionally, investment companies over the past six funding cycles have, on average, paid only 6% in total of the accounting support fee. And then of that, the number of investment companies that fall within the $250 million to $500 million range, it's about 1,500 companies. That's 33% of the investment companies that are assessed a portion of the fee. However, they only pay 5% of the total amount assessed to investment companies. So that's essentially 0.3% of the total accounting support fee. So allocating that less than 1% to those 2,500 companies that we would be excluding, we find that it's not as efficient as it could be if we were exclude those 2,500 companies and the lower, smaller companies to decrease the burden on them and also make the funding process more efficient without having much of an effect on those larger, the other companies that would be assessed portions of the fees.
Thank you. And I want to associate myself with Mr. Niemeyer's remarks. You never know when there's going to be a glitch in the system. And inevitably, there are glitches in the system. But I think our allocation and collection process here is done extraordinarily well. And so I want to thank the staff and everybody involved in it and in making it work the way it does.
Thank you. If there isn't any other discussion, then the motion before the board is to direct the staff to release the proposed funding rules and funding rule changes for public comment for 60 days. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. That's the end of our agenda for today, but before we adjourn, I'd like to make a brief statement about another matter, and that matter is the establishment of a new Office of Outreach and Small Business Liaison. As we've already discussed today, the Dodd-Frank Act vested the board with the authority over the auditors of all SEC-registered securities brokers and dealers. The great majority of the more than 500 additional accounting firms that have registered with the board because they perform broker-dealer audits are, like their broker-dealer clients, small businesses. Since beginning operations, the board has sought to maintain open lines of communication with the small business community. However, in light of the board's new authority and the large number of smaller accounting firms and broker-dealers that will be affected by it, the board has reassessed its communications and outreach strategy. As a result, the board has decided to establish an Office of Outreach and Small Business Liaison. This new office will act as a point of contact and communication between the board and any PCOB-registered public accounting firm or any other person affected by the board's regulatory activities, including, in particular, those in the small business community. In October, the board asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to approve the formation of this new office. On December 10th, last Friday, the Commission issued an order approving the Board's request. The new Office of Outreach will be responsible for planning and conducting a program of small business forums including both the board's existing forums on auditing in the small business environment and new forums directed to the smaller broker-dealer and broker-dealer auditor communities. The office will also seek input from the small business community, including public companies, brokers, and others, on issues related to the board's work. The office will serve as a communication channel for anyone with questions about the board's activities and will be charged with identifying areas where information related to board work is not well understood and suggesting action to address the issue. The director of the Office of Outreach and Small Business Liaison will report directly to the board's chairman. I'm very pleased to announce that Mary Soquist will serve as the office's first director. Mary has been with the board almost since its inception, first as counsel to board member Gradison, and then as the board's director of communications. She's been closely involved with issues relating to the small business community throughout her career, which has included working on small business issues as a lawyer in private practice and during her tenure in the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance. She's long played an active role in the Securities Subcommittee of the American Bar Association's Middle Market and Small Business Committee. I want to stress that the board's other communications functions, press relations, and government and congressional affairs, will continue to play an active role in the board's work. These functions, which were part of the Office of Communications, will be reconstituted as separate offices, the Office of Public Affairs and the Office of Government Relations. Colleen Brennan will head the Office of Public Affairs, and Kent Bonham will head the Office of Government Relations. I believe that this reorganization of our communications group will help to better serve the needs of both the small business community and others, including investors, who interact with the board or who are affected by its activities. I look forward to working with Mary in her new role. And we will be posting more information about the Office of Outreach and how to contact it on the board's website probably later today or tomorrow. That's all I have, unless there are other questions or comments or business. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.